Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In the news this week, the wheels on the bus did not go round and round, not on Tuesday anyway.
A wildcat strike by drivers left 30,000 students without their usual way to get to school.
It was wrong, but either way you look at it, it had to be done.
City officials were surprised and furious.
This is illegal. We'll not allow them to use our students as pawns. And we'll make sure this illegal behavior has consequences.
Also, the race for mayor becomes a contest over endorsements, and a new poll shows an early advantage.
John Connolly is currently leading by 7 points, 41-34%, with 23 undecided.
And the government shutdown is felt across the state, including in the race to fill Senator Ed Markey's old congressional seat.
Because if we give in to the Tea Party on Obamacare, for example, for 1 year, you can't tell me we'll come back in a year from now and go back to the table.
We'll roll through these stories with our Week in Review panelists. Jim O'Sullivan, politics editor at Boston.com, joins us. Hey, Jim, good to have you.
Thanks for having me very much.
And David Scharfenberg, politics and policy reporter for WBUR. Good to see you here, David. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And let's start with that surprise wildcat strike by school bus drivers that idled almost all of the city's 650 school buses earlier this week. Angered city officials, it complicated the lives of school administrators, parents, and more than 30,000 students across the city. The bus drivers say they were upset over changes in their health care plan, payroll problems, and a number of other grievances with the transportation company that runs the buses. Here's bus driver Tony DePina earlier this week.
This company, they have no respect. They don't follow our contract. So they've been suspended driver. There is a lot of rules they didn't follow, you know what I'm saying? You know, we have a contract for a long time, for 30 years, right? We have this contract. They tried to deny us. They don't recognize us, you know. So that's why we do this.
But Boston Mayor Tom Menino called the strike illegal, and the city went to court to try to force the drivers back to work.
This illegal work stoppage has affected 33,000 students, the Boston Public Schools, the parochial schools, charter, and private schools. This is illegal.
So the drivers are members of the United Steelworkers Union, which also condemned the job action. Jim O'Sullivan, let me start with you. What have we learned about the strike this week? First of all, about the particular grievances, or what strikes you about this story?
Well, what struck me is sort of the dissension that cropped up within labor. You talk to labor officials from other unions, and they say, this is even those guys who empathize with the complaints that the bus drivers have, I think it's a bit of a bridge too far. It really sort of reminded more of a public safety issue where you have little kids left standing on sidewalks. This isn't the trash not getting picked up. This isn't even a teacher strike where the teachers don't come into the classrooms. It really became about the safety of the kids. And I'm not sure if the bus drivers union had gamed that out in its mind when it thought about going on this wildcat strike where you're going to have people legitimately concerned about the safety of young children. And that's why you had, I think, even folks who would be natural allies of a union action like this sort of backed away from this one.
Yeah, and David, what did you make of the mayor's handling of this? The city tried to go to court to get an injunction. That failed, but he came out pretty strongly against this, obviously.
He did. He was kind of back on his bully pulpit again. He's faded a bit with all the attention on the race to succeed him, but we saw the kind of combative, pugnacious Tom Menino we all know up before reporters again. And it just reminded me how much we've grown used to this as the style of leadership in this city. And we're all going to be in for a little bit of a shock, I think, when the man steps down in January and we have a new style at that pulpit.
Yeah. Jim, what about you? What did you see in the mayor's comportment around this issue?
Oh, no, I think David nailed it. This is where Menino excels, right? With a sort of a public fight, he could take a clear position. He can say, I'm on the side of the children, the school parents, and come out and sort of delineate the battle lines. And you really saw Councillor Connolly and Representative Walsh follow that lead and sort of get the mayor's back on that.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that in a second. One more question, though, just about sort of where we are with this strike. It seems like it's over for now, but there's still a threat of future disruptions. Jim, do you have a sense that the city's out of the woods on this, or where are we?
Well, I know they're still concerned about it, and I think one of the reasons is because you have these traditional labor allies who proved, certainly on day one, ineffectual in turning things around. The normal pressure points, you know, the National Union, the United Steelworkers came out and said, we don't have their back on this. This is a wildcat thing. It's as the mayor put it, a rogue element, a rogue faction within the union that people don't really seem to be able to control. So even though the bus drivers lost, I think, pretty clearly the public relations and perception battle on day one and day two, you saw them come back. Are they aggravated enough about their grievances that they want to take that risk again? I think we'll see.
And David and Jim, not surprisingly, this immediately became fodder for the mayor's race between John Connolly and Marty Walsh. Marty Walsh that afternoon was speaking in Eggleston Square, and this is what he had to say.
The actions of the school bus drivers union this morning were outrageous, unlawful, and put the safety of our children at risk.
Actually, that was John Connolly. He was on the steps of the State House on Tuesday morning. Here's what Marty Walsh had to say that same afternoon.
It's against the law what they did today, and they need to go back to work. And if they're not, I'm sure the mayor's mentioned this, you should go to the court, get an injunction to either get them back to work, and if they don't go back, you have to remove them.
Now, this work stoppage puts both of these guys in a potentially tricky situation. You know, you have John Connolly, ed reformer, and Marty Walsh, the labor advocate. Jim, I'm interested in your thoughts on how Connolly is approaching this. Is he capitalizing on it? Is it difficult for him to navigate in any way, or is this easy?
Well, I think it's an easy one for both of them because, like I said, there is that image of the little kids standing out there. What I think is really interesting is that we've had two so-called October surprises so far in this race. You had the bus strike this week, and before that, the police arbitration settlement. And both of those have been union-tied, and both of them have put Walsh in more of a difficult position by shedding light on some of the problems the city is having and could have with public employee unions. You think of labor as one of Walsh's staunchest allies. Well, here we've had two cases where they've kind of put him in a box. And on this one, on the bus one, he had a clearer path out. It was easy for him to sort of go after the union a little bit, call it illegal, and call for them to get back to work. But the unions are some of Marty Walsh's best friends, and they're not making life easy for him here.
And David Scharfenberg, how do you feel about that? I mean, here we have Jim O'Sullivan saying this is easy for both of them, but Marty Walsh presents himself as the union candidate. Is this at all treacherous to navigate for him?
It is. It is. I think, especially when it comes to public employee unions, which in the case of the police, the bus drivers are not technically public unions, but there's a perception out there that these unions sometimes have narrow interests, that they're out for themselves. And so while Marty is really trying to turn his labor background into something broader, make himself kind of the champion of the working class, it gets a little more difficult when you have these unions getting big pay hikes that your average blue-collar person who may not be unionized is not seeing. So it is tough. I think the silver lining for him, the bus strike, was, as Jim was suggesting, is that was a bit of an easy one, stand with the kids there, and it was an opportunity for him to say, look, I can stand up to unions when required.
So let's stick with the mayor's race. It was a busy week in many ways. There were endorsements. There was a new poll showing John Connolly holding on to about a 7-point lead in the race. Let's talk about the endorsements for a minute. On Tuesday, Marty Walsh picked up the endorsement of two of his former rivals, Felix Arroyo and John Barros, who wanted to be mayor as well. Here's Barros explaining his pick of Walsh.
This is about picking a candidate that is sharing a common vision about Boston and that who we believe, Marty Walsh, we believe Marty Walsh as mayor of Boston will be an inclusive mayor who will make sure that everyone participates in this economy and that we have the best schools and that our children are taken care of. And I am excited to be here to endorse Marty today.
John Barros there endorsing Marty Walsh for mayor. Now, yesterday, more than a dozen black clergy members endorsed John Connolly, including the Reverend Minyard Culpepper of Dorchester and the Pastor William E. Dickerson of the Greater Love Tabernacle Church, among a whole batch of other clergy members. David, conventional wisdom says often in political races that endorsements aren't that important. What's your take on the significance of these endorsements this week?
I think the conventional wisdom is generally right. Endorsements don't add to a whole lot. I think what the Walsh camp is hoping is that if they can run the table here, if they can get Charlotte Golar-Ritchie, who finished third in the preliminary election, the only woman in the race, black woman, if they can get all three of them, Golar-Ritchie, John Barros, and Felix Arroyo, then voters might say, you know, wait a minute, what do these people know that I don't know? Perhaps take a second look at Marty if they're a bit skeptical of him to begin with. I think it sends a signal not only to black and Latino voters potentially, but to kind of white, ideologically liberal voters who might vote for Barack Obama. But it's going to take, I think, perhaps even more to have a real impact. And even then, I'm a little skeptical about the impact.
Yeah. What about you, Jim?
I think David's got it right. I think a lot of times these endorsements get overplayed because, let's face it, they are easy for us to cover. It's sort of a ready-made story. In this race in particular, where it might matter is because if you look at the map and where John Conley and Marty Walsh did very well, it's on those largely white, traditionally high-voting sort of outlying neighborhoods on different ends of the city. Walsh did very well in South Boston and in Eastern Dorchester. Conley romped in West Roxbury, did well. They actually both did well in Charlestown. It's that middle of the city where they didn't do as well and where candidates of color did better with Ritchie performing. She won four awards, Barros, Arroyo. If they can move voters in a direction, I think that could make a difference, perhaps not dispositive. But the other thing, and David spoke to this, is for Walsh in particular, he's trying to expand that profile that he has of beyond just the union guy, the building trades guy. If he can sort of mollify the progressives who see him coming from a more traditional sort of conservative Irish Catholic background, his voting record really is I think far more progressive than that impression. And if endorsements by former candidates who are seen as more progressive, more liberal, can reassure those folks, I think that could be enormously helpful to Walsh.
Well, let's talk a little bit, stick a little bit with this theme of these candidates reaching out to the city's minority neighborhoods and that trove of votes. We caught up earlier this week with John Connolly. He was campaigning in Grove Hall, talking about a number of proposals to promote female and minority-owned businesses in Roxbury. Here's what he said.
So we've talked about a Made in Boston venture capital fund that would pool assets from banks and lend at lower rates to small businesses and businesses owned by people of color and women so that we can take the principles of those tech company innovation startup zones and we could actually bring them to Roxbury focused on developing small businesses.
So there's mayoral candidate John Connolly campaigning in Grove Hall. David, who do you think has the advantage so far in this all-important part of the city in this quest for votes?
I think what's interesting about what we just heard John Connolly say is I had a piece this week on the radio about kind of the class divide in this race. John has some natural constituency in that more affluent western edge of the city. They like what he's said about education, about the innovation economy. He's really taking that message and trying to make it relevant in black and Latino Boston in the heart of the city. He's talked about education being vitally important to those families, which it certainly is. And just then we heard him talk about taking that kind of high-tech innovation model and bringing it in to Roxbury and Dorchester. So that's really his pitch, and we'll see on Election Day how it works out for him.
Yeah. Well, Jim, next Tuesday, Walsh and Connolly are going to debate for the first time, the first of four debates. What do you expect to hear, or sort of, you know, where is the center of this debate going to fall? What are they going to actually be debating about, other than I'd be a better mayor than you?
Well, I think you're going to hear a lot about education. Conley's done a terrific job since the outset, not just of this campaign, but really of his career. He's made education a hallmark. And politically, why that's so advantageous is that it allows him to, you know, as an at-large city councilor, he's got an excuse to be in all the neighborhoods. But that's an issue that cuts across all the neighborhoods. Everybody cares about it. Everybody wants the schools to be better. High-voting people want the schools to be better. And he's sort of fashioned that into an education issue. I think Walsh needs to cut into that a little bit and say, look, I've voted for education reform. I'm a supporter of charter schools. I've been involved in charter schools. And I think you're going to see a little bit of a back and forth. The comedy, if you will, of the preliminary election was quickly dispensed with in really the days afterwards. And these are two candidates who, while they may have worked together on issues in the past, aren't necessarily in love with each other. Both of these guys have wanted to be mayor for a very long time. Both of them realize that this is probably their best shot. And I think, you know, to use the old cliche, I think the gloves will come off a little bit.
David, what are you most curious to see in that debate, to see and hear?
I think Jim is right. I'll be looking for a tougher bit of rhetoric. We've already seen some sniping back and forth. It'll be interesting to see that when they're on the stage. I wonder if Marty will attempt to make use of his biography a bit. He's talked about being the son of a laborer, battling alcoholism. I think he clearly sees that as a way to the heart of kind of the average working voter out there. We'll see if he makes use of that in the debate.
David and Jim, another race going on, one that's getting significantly less attention than the mayor's race, is the one to succeed Ed Markey in the U.S. House now that he's in the Senate. And this week, the candidates were debating on Neckin, and the government shutdown became a bit of an issue. There were a lot of different views about what each candidate would do if elected. So let's listen to a little sampling from a few of them. First up, here's Republican Mike Stopa, whose day job, by the way, is teaching physics at Harvard.
I'd have to say I'm a Ted Cruz guy. I mean, I think that when Obamacare was passed 3 years ago, the Democrats went through any kind of parliamentary procedures they needed to just to get it through. And I think that the president is politicizing the shutdown. I mean, particularly shutting down the World War II monument.
Again, that's Republican Mike Stopa. Here is Republican Frank Adevinola, who says that the Affordable Care Act should be delayed.
The American people don't understand the implications of this law. And what we should do is we should delay it to allow people to have a better appreciation for the inefficiencies.
Finally, a Democrat. This is Catherine Clark, and she picked up the endorsement from The Globe this week, and she echoed what many of her fellow candidates also said.
We cannot give in to the extremist Republicans who are holding our very economy hostage. We need to move forward, get a clean, continuing resolution, end the shutdown, pay our bills that Congress has already approved and put on a credit card that are now due.
Jim O'Sullivan, we've seen the Republican brand take a real hit in the polls over the shutdown. Do you think that will be a factor in this race?
I think the factor in this race is going to be the low turnout. It's sort of flown under the radar. You've got, you know, I would love to see a poll on voter fatigue in Massachusetts because it just seems like it's one special after another. I'm not sure how many folks are aware that the election is even going on. And that is a heavily Democratic district. So whoever comes out of the Democratic primary will be the sort of the heavy favorite. But this is something that's been overshadowed from the get-go. For all the attention that the fairly sleepy U.S. Senate race got, it's been a fraction of that on the congressional side.
And David, the primary is actually next week. Do you want to sort of speculate on who you think is likely to win?
I think it's pretty wide open. You've got five kind of legitimate candidates on the Democratic side, and as Jim said, whoever wins the Democratic nomination is going to win this thing. Catherine Clark got the Globe endorsement. She's certainly up there. Peter Katugin, I think, is one to look out for. Karen Spilka has kind of the western part of the district out by Framingham to herself a bit, so she's got some geographical advantages. Carl Shortino has kind of staked himself out as the liberal guy. Will Brownsberger is the maverick. So they've all got their appeal. I think it's tough to predict at this point.
All right. Before the two of you go, our weekly hubbub in which we try to pick out little tidbits from the news that may have gone under the radar. Jim, do you want to let us know what stood out to you?
Sure. Well, just sort of segueing from the attention that gets paid to politics, the Herald had a piece, Joe Battenfeld today sort of flicked at it. I think as folks, and God willing, the Red Sox will be playing for quite some time. If you look back and talk to folks who were around for the 1975 mayoral election, they will tell you that Joe Timmelty was gaining on Kevin White. And then once the Sox started playing the Reds in the World Series, there was kind of a freeze put on politics, and everybody turned to sports and everybody turned to baseball, and it consumed the town. As this mayoral election heads into its final weeks, and the Sox, if they hang around for a little while, could consume those column inches and those times on the newscasts, I think you're going to see a bit of a crowding out effect in terms of the bandwidth of the public attention here.
And David Scharfenberg?
This is a little bit lighter. New website out there for all you folks frustrated with the shutdown, drunkdialcongress.org.
I saw this yesterday.
You can encouraging you to call in drunk and leave your congressman a piece of your mind. I'll leave it at that.
And Anthony?
Well, I think it seems strange to be talking about this as a hubbub because usually we like to define the hubbubs as those stories that might have fallen sort of beneath the radar or below the fold. But I got to talk a little bit about the Red Sox because I think one of the facts that really amazed me is here you've got these two storied franchises that are about to meet and decide who wins the pennant, Detroit and Boston. They've been playing each other since 1901. They've never met in the postseason. I just find that amazing.
Oh, wow.
I think that's just really interesting. But I think it's a really interesting matchup. And Jim, since you brought up reference to Red Sox, I'm curious, who do you like? Who do you think is going to prevail?
Well, since they're soon to be my coworkers, in the interest of full disclosure, I've got to see the Sox. I think the Sox are looking good. I'm a little nervous about Detroit's pitching. You may have seen what Verlander did last night. He was lights out. So I think how they set the rotation will be kind of interesting. Lackey's been a little rough on the road, so I wouldn't mind seeing Lackey go game two, maybe at home. And then maybe a Buchholz-Verlander matchup in game three would be nice.
Pretty exciting. Well, I'm nervous about Detroit, but I'm sticking with my gut feeling that the Red Sox are the team of destiny this year. So we'll see how it plays out. How about you, Sasha?
So
what's your hubbub?
For my hubbub, to call it real estate news doesn't really do it justice, but I'm sure that all of us in this studio, Anthony and David, and I'm sure, Jim, you over there in the Globe newsroom, are familiar with that incredible house on the Arbor Way, which is basically a mansion. It's that one that at Christmas has that huge Christmas light display costs the owners thousands every month. Well, it is for sale again. It is a short sale, valued for tax purposes at $1.7 million, but listed for $1.45 million. And what you get for that is 14 rooms, 11 fireplaces, and a swimming pool. So next time you drive by, size that up and decide whether that's within reach. We want to say thank you to David Scharfenberg, politics and policy reporter for WBUR, and also Jim O'Sullivan, politics editor at Boston.com, our Week in Review panelist this week. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Stick with us. Coming up, Wanderlust and Watercolors. John Singer Sargent at the MFA. An amazing collection of his watercolors, which he did as he roamed across Europe and the Middle East at the turn of the century. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.